From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ebola outbreak. The Turks preparing for the fall of a key border town in Syria. Dialogue in Hong Kong, plus something new from singers Tony Bennett and Lady Gaga. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A Spanish nurse who helped treat an Ebola patient in a Madrid hospital has contracted the virus, becoming the first person to become infected outside of West Africa. Spanish health officials said Monday the nurse was part of a medical team that treated a 69-year-old Spanish priest who died in a hospital last month after being flown back from Sierra Leone. Spanish Health Minister Ana Mato said they are working with Madrid's regional health care system and its experts in order to find formulas to treat the patient in the best methods possible. Meantime, that Ebola outbreak was on the agenda Monday at a meeting at the White House here in Washington. President Obama met with his national security team and allowed reporters in following their discussions.
I'll be very honest with you, although we have seen great interest on the part of the international community, we have not seen other countries step up as aggressively as they need to. And I said at the United Nations, and I will repeat, that this is an area where everybody has to chip in and everybody has to move quickly in order for us to get this under control.
Mr. Obama also spoke about the chances of an Ebola outbreak in the United States.
I know that the American people are concerned about the possibility of an Ebola outbreak, and Ebola is a very serious disease. The ability of people who are infected to carry that across borders is something that we have to take extremely seriously. At the same time, it is important for Americans to know the facts, and that is that because of the measures that we've put in place, as well as our world-class health system, and the nature of the Ebola virus itself, which is difficult to transmit, the chances of an Ebola outbreak in the United States is extremely low.
Already hospitalized in the U.S. is a critically ill Liberian man. Thomas Duncan has begun receiving an experimental drug at a Dallas, Texas hospital. Once again, President Obama.
In recent months, we've had thousands of travelers arriving here from West Africa, and so far only one case of Ebola has been diagnosed in the United States, and that's the patient in Dallas. Our prayers are obviously with him and his family.
President Obama also noted that out of Thomas Duncan's case have come some insights.
We have learned some lessons, though, in terms of what happened in Dallas. We don't have a lot of margin for error. The procedures and protocols that are put in place must be followed. One of the things that we discussed today was how we can make sure that we're spreading the word across hospitals, clinics, any place where a patient might first come in contact with a medical worker to make sure that they know what to look out for and they're putting in place the protocols and following those protocols strictly.
An American freelance video journalist has arrived back in the U.S. from Liberia, where he had been working with a crew from NBC TV News. 33-year-old Ashoka Mokpo was able to walk off the plane before being loaded onto a stretcher and taken to an ambulance, and his father said his symptoms of fever and nausea appeared mild. Well, that Ebola outbreak has grabbed global attention and sparked panic in some cases, and it's killed more than 3,500 people across West Africa. But medical experts say with Ebola needs a lot of attention, they say, the world also cannot lose sight of other health issues such as HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria, which they say kills far more people each day. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to medical experts on the front line of the epidemic. Her report is part of a project on Ebola produced in cooperation with the U.S. State Department.
Ebola has ravaged the nations of Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, infecting thousands of people and killing more than half of them. The scale has prompted the United Nations to declare an unprecedented health mission to combat the virus, and the United States to commit thousands of troops to West Africa. Despite all that attention, Ebola is nowhere close to being the biggest killer on the planet, or even in Africa. Every day, the juggernauts of the infectious disease world, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, kill nearly 10,000 people, the WHO estimates. But WHO spokesman Tarek Yasarevich says this latest Ebola explosion is still truly terrifying because of the disease's violent nature and its devastating impact on communities. He spoke to VOA from Conakry, Guinea.
The way people suffer, it's something terrifying. The symptoms start with a fever, but then there's a lot of diarrhea, bleeding, vomiting. It's a very stressful situation for family members and also for health workers. People who have not been in a treatment center may be dying outside. People know that they should not be touching something. There may be cases where bodies are being just left out. So all this makes people very afraid of this disease, and basically also the point is you should not be touching other people. There is this fear and anxiety. It's really can mark the society. It can have a psychological impact on the community.
Dr. Tom Ellman of Medical Aid Group Doctors Without Borders agrees that an aggressive response to Ebola is needed. The group, which goes by its French acronym MSF, has been a fixture on Ebola's front lines.
The focus on Ebola is needed at the moment. What we must ensure is that the world is able to increase its focus on other areas like HIV and TB as well.
But Ellman, who directs the aid agency's Southern Africa Medical Unit, says the longer Ebola persists, and the WHO predicts this epidemic could last several years, the more he worries about the longer-standing threats.
The big worry that we have at the moment in general is firstly looking at Ebola, how long it took for the world to wake up and recognize that there was a global responsibility to support the response, but also how we're seeing now a fallback in funding around HIV and TB, and they're very, very concerned that over the next few years, we are going to see a return to business as usual on the response to infectious diseases and insufficient funding to maintain what we've achieved so far, which in HIV and TB over the last 10 years has been an incredible response in improving access to diagnosis, treatment, and prevention.
Both organizations think that more, not less, needs to be done to fight Ebola. Yasarevich says they are concerned about the effect the disease is having on overall health systems in the three affected countries.
It is true that especially, again, in those three countries, Ebola outbreak is heavily impacting health systems. There is less health personnel in existing facilities, and many of them have to deal with Ebola. And when there are Ebola patients in one facility, other people who have other medical conditions may not wish to come in fear of not getting Ebola. So there is a really reduction of healthcare services other than Ebola being available to the population of those three countries.
Ebola continues to kill, with the virus recently making landfall in the United States. But medical experts in Africa want policymakers to understand that for every life Ebola takes, HIV, TB, and malaria take thousands more. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Kurdish fighters and Islamic State militants are engaged in a fierce clash over control of the Syrian border town of Kobani, with both sides heavily getting heavy casualties. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported at least 27 militants, 19 Kurds, have been killed in fighting on Sunday and Monday. Jamie Detmer is at the Turkish-Syrian border with more on the plight of the people of Kobani.
Overnight Sunday, Islamic State militants took a hill overlooking the battered town, and two black flags with Arabic writing were raised on Kobani's outskirts. But on Monday, Kurdish fighters claimed they had managed to repel the militants and retake the strategic ground, keeping IS from reaching the town centre. Ibrahim Benici, a Kurdish member of the Turkish parliament, said Monday that IS fighters now control the south of the town, while the Kurds are clinging on in the north. The situation remained fluid. The fighting has become increasingly vicious in recent days. A female Kurdish fighter, a mother of two, mounted a lone attack on a group of jihadists on the east side of Kobani, hurling grenades at them before blowing herself up, according to Kurdish sources. Jihadists have been posting online photographs of themselves holding up the heads of decapitated Kurdish women fighters. Turkish authorities appear to be demonstrating their belief that the town is on the verge of falling to the Islamic militants. They instructed the press, who've been observing the unfolding battle for the past few days from the vantage point of a hill overlooking the town, to move back about 2 kilometres. And Turkish police deployed in large numbers to block entrances to several Turkish villages running down to the border. But the police were not ordering residents to leave all the villages, and with their riot shields, they seem more concerned to keep at bay hundreds of Kurds who flocked from across Turkey to express their solidarity with the Kurds of Kobani and to protest Ankara's reluctance to intervene militarily. The jailed leader of the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan, who's been engaged in peace talks with Ankara, warned last week from his prison cell that he would end the peace process if Kobani falls. PKK activists who spoke to VOA News on Monday appeared eager to reignite the 30-year insurgency inside Turkey in the event Islamic State seizes the Syrian border town. There'll be war in Turkey, said one Kurdish activist. Another said he agreed with Öcalan that the peace process should be ended, and he blamed the Turkish government for not saving Kobani. Jamie Detmer, Surak, VOA News.
The student-led pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong appeared Monday to be more subdued than in recent days. However, a few hundred protesters remain camped out, vying to keep up with the pressure on the Hong Kong government until officials there are more sincere, responding to the students' demands. Dillis Hui is a student at the Chinese University of Hong Kong.
I have a lot of concern on the situation like this, and actually this morning I went back to CUHK and I, together with some of my colleagues, to urge students not go to school but come join this campaign.
Student activists like Wei, who've been leading a week-long occupation of the streets, are set to have more talks with a government official today to discuss how to start a dialogue and democratic reform. Hong Kong Federation of Students says it agreed with the official on several terms of a public dialogue that could begin as early as this week. It says those items include both sides treating others as equals and the government being required to carry out any deals reached in the meetings. Sunny Low is a political scientist at Hong Kong Institute of Education.
So the question here is, if the student protesters sit down with the government negotiators, are they going to produce a political reform model acceptable to other Democrats and also to the members of the public? If not, this would be regarded as a secret negotiation.
Low also expressed skepticism about whether the negotiations might be successful.
The protesters and the government negotiators may fail to come up with a satisfactory solution on political reform, and eventually the police crackdown on the protest movement will be inevitable, resulting in possible arrest and even more resistance from some of the protesters.
Pro-democracy student campaigners say differences remain, such as whether the dialogue with the government will be casual or formal and what kinds of democratic reforms would be on the agenda. Hong Kong's chief executive, Leung Chun-ying, said Monday his government is sincere in having a dialogue with the protesters on constitutional development. Activists are demanding the reversal of a Chinese government ruling that Hong Kong can only elect its leader under universal suffrage in 2017 if candidates are vetted by a pro-Beijing committee. Hong Kong officials have said they must abide by that ruling. Also in the news, NATO's plan to beef up its military presence in Eastern Europe does not violate a post-Cold War deal struck with Russia on military force levels in the region. That, according to the new alliance chief, Jens Stoltenberg. At an Air Force base in central Poland on Monday, Stoltenberg said he was committed to implementing a plan for a new rapid reaction force conceived to reassure NATO member states in Eastern Europe alarmed by Russia's intervention in Ukraine.
NATO believes in a rule-based international order, and therefore we are respecting our international commitments. And what we do now with the reassurance measures, with more military presence in the eastern part of our alliance.
Stoltenberg's choice of Poland as the venue for his first trip outside of NATO headquarters was symbolic. Poland is one of the most hawkish of the ex-Soviet alliance members toward Russia. He's known for his skills in forging compromise and for his knowledge of Russia. As Norwegian premier, Stoltenberg built a personal friendship with Russia's then-president, Dmitry Medvedev. Relations between Moscow and NATO are at a post-Cold War low over Russia's actions in Ukraine, where Moscow, as well as supporting separatists, annexed the Crimean Peninsula in March after protesters overthrew Kiev's pro-Moscow president. NATO has made it clear it will not intervene militarily in Ukraine, which is not an alliance member.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
And now a little something from our music department. Well, jazz was born about a century ago in the U.S. African-American communities, then evolved over the decades into an inclusive form of music, incorporating and enriching the sounds of immigrant cultures and the country's changing society. Well, speaking of jazz, legendary crooner Tony Bennett has recorded a jazz album called Cheek to Cheek with pop star Lady Gaga. Jeff London spoke with the artist.
You might think they go together like oil and water or chalk and cheese.
I think it's probably what a lot of people are thinking when they hear Tony Bennett wants to do a jazz album with Lady Gaga, and they say, huh? What are you talking about?
It's not the first time Lady Gaga has recorded with Tony Bennett. The pair collaborated on The Lady is a Tramp for his previous duets album, which won a Grammy.
Too hungry for dinner at 8.
I'm starving.
She loves the theater, but she never comes late.
I never bother with people that I hate. That's why this chick is a tramp.
The two decided to team up for a full album of standards. And Bennett says Lady Gaga's up to the challenge.
She's actually a very authentic jazz singer. She'll turn a phrase, she'll make it different for, because of the moment that she's singing. And so what happens is it keeps the songs alive. The interpretations become very intimate and everlasting.
I used to visit all the very gay places, those come what may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of life.
Like Bennett, Lady Gaga was born in New York City, and she's actually been singing jazz since she was a kid. But she's, of course, best known for her pop songs and her over-the-top stage shows, which draw sellout crowds around the world. So why did she decide to record with Tony Bennett?
He's brought out a subtlety in me that I've missed for a while because my life is very noisy.
But the new record is not, says New Yorker pop music critic Sasha Frere Jones.
You know, her records have become increasingly sonically so crowded, so noisy, but not with noise, just sort of noisy with information that I don't understand what's going on exactly. And this is a wide open, fairly natural record. I'm sure there's some editing involved in there, but you know, she's there.
The greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return.
I don't know what the world will make of it, but it's actually pretty good.
Frere Jones points out that Lady Gaga is more than pop spectacle. She can really play piano and sing. She says working with the 88-year-old Bennett has been a real education.
I love watching Tony perform. I always sit in the theater and watch when he's performing without me with his quartet.
They say into your early life romance came.
Tony Bennett hopes the learning experience extends to Lady Gaga's audience.
It's the first time that young people that love you so much will fall in love with George Gershwin.
Oh, yeah.
With Cole Porter.
Oh, yeah.
With Irving Berlin.
And most of them, a lot of them, surprisingly, know some of those songs. And they're sort of getting more and more and more excited, and it's becoming cooler for them to talk about who wrote what. Tony's really opening up a whole new generation.
They all laughed at Christopher Columbus when he said the world was round.
They all laughed when Edison recorded sound.
I feel very validated by this. You know, he's given my fans a gift by saying to them that he likes the way I sing jazz.
They also seem to genuinely like each other. They will be on stage singing together in a televised concert in October. And in case any of Lady Gaga's fans are curious about who wrote what, Bennett promises there will be visuals identifying the songwriters at the start of every song. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Give you anything but love, baby. That's the only thing I've plenty of, baby.
I mean, who knew Lady Gaga could sing like that? Well, at least I didn't. Oh, well, anyway, enough of that now. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to the Voice of America today for International Edition. We're going to make this quick. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We're going to get back now to a little bit more of Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett singing I Can't Give You Anything But Love.
With diamond watches, Tiffany's just on sale, baby. Until that lucky day, you know darn well. Oh, I can't give you anything but love.
I can't give you anything but love. Lady, that's the only thing I've plenty of. Lady, dream a while, scheme a while. You're sure to find happiness and I guess all the things you've always pined for. How'd you like to see me looking swell? Lady, diamond bracelets won't Gaga.
This is Today in History. On October 7th, 2001, less than a month after Al-Qaeda terrorists flew commercial jets into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, President Bush announced that American troops were on the offensive in Afghanistan. Their goal was to stamp out Afghanistan's Taliban regime, which had aided Al-Qaeda and its leader Osama bin Laden.
More than 2 weeks ago, I gave Taliban leaders a series of clear and specific demands. Close terrorist training camps, hand over leaders of the Al-Qaeda network, and return all foreign nationals, including American citizens, unjustly detained in your country. None of these demands were met. And now, the Taliban will pay a price.
Mr. Bush vowed to continue to take what he called the war on terror to those countries that sponsored, harbored, or trained terrorists. 18 months later, his war on terror would focus on Iraq. October 7, 1582 was skipped altogether by people in Italy, Poland, Portugal, and Spain because of the implementation of the Gregorian calendar. The Gregorian or Western calendar is today the most widely accepted internationally. On this date in 1976, Hua Guofeng became Mao Zedong's successor as chairman of the Communist Party of China. On this day in 1985, four Palestinian terrorists hijacked the Italian cruise ship Achille Lauro off the coast of Egypt and held more than 400 passengers hostage to their demand for the release of 50 Palestinians held by Israel. The hijackers abandoned the liner 2 days later after shooting a wheelchair-bound passenger, American Leon Klinghoffer, because he was Jewish. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As world leaders met last month in New York for the opening of the 69th session of the United Nations General Assembly, the United States worked to focus greater attention and pressure toward ending the political crisis in South Sudan. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called a September 25th high-level meeting to discuss the dire humanitarian crisis caused by the conflict there and the growing frustration in the international community that despite President Salva Kiir's and former Vice President Riek Machar's recommitment to cease hostilities, fighting continues. Even as the parties resumed national unity talks in Ethiopia, mediated by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, government troops and opposition forces loyal to the former vice president clashed again in Upper Nile State, leaving almost 200 dead. U.S. officials taking part in the UN meeting told participants that the fighting has driven 1.8 million people, close to 20% of the population, from their homes, almost 500,000 of them into refugee camps in neighboring nations. Some 40% of South Sudanese are in need of food assistance, all in a man-made crisis that can only be settled through inclusive peace talks, not on the battlefield. Ambassador Donald Booth is U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan.
We urge that everyone who has been party to the talks to date, whether the political parties, civil society, the religious communities, be allowed to continue to participate in the negotiations.
Fighting erupted in December 2013 when a political dispute within the country's ruling party, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, turned violent. Political conflict erupted into intercommunal fighting with a cost of more than 10,000 lives. The United States and international community are putting pressure on the warring parties in other ways as well. The United States has imposed sanctions on individuals from both sides of the conflict who are responsible for gross violations of human rights or violations of the cessation of hostilities agreement. More may be imposed. Again, Ambassador Booth.
We will continue to look with our Troika EU partners and IGAD, other ways of increasing the costs of continuing the conflict as a way of pressuring the parties to negotiate seriously.
The United States is fully supportive of the IGAD mediation effort and stands with the people of South Sudan. President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar must assume their responsibilities to prevent further needless suffering.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.